Good afternoon, everybody. The time is, well, about 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Tuesday, July 14th. I'm Alan Chartok. We're going to talk about Iran. We're going to talk about Israel today, and it's important. The world's diplomats reached an agreement early this morning in Vienna that will curb Iran's nuclear program. It has been a focal point of President Barack Obama's foreign policy, and he's lauding it as a historic success. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, on the other hand, is less than thrilled, calling it a historic mistake. What do you think? What about this agreement, which in a nutshell offers Iran relief from sanctions in exchange for limits on its nuclear activities, reshape relations between Iran and the West for good? Call us at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and if it gets too busy, and it will, you can always signal us online at VoxPop at WAMC.org. Well, Professor, thank you so much for being with us. It's really, really great of you to take the time. I know that we didn't give you enough time to think about it, but you're a WAMC-er at heart, and you decided you were going to help us out, and we appreciate it very much. Okay, so, Tom, if I may call you that, what in fact do you make of this? Is this the Republicans and some and Netanyahu and others are saying too risky, can't trust these guys, never can trust them, they're bad people. What do you think?
Well, I mean, this is a historic deal. It reminds me of the deal that we made with the Soviet Union in the heat of the Cold War. It reminds me of the Nixon trip to China and our completely changed relations with China. Each time there are extended negotiations with a long-term enemy, there are those that say we can't trust them. And in the case of the Soviet Union and the case of China, they have been proven wrong. So I think this extended long negotiation with Iran that Obama began, but actually began years before, this extended negotiation was necessary. It ends 35 years of really nasty enmity, and we'll see where it goes. It's just the first step.
I wanted to ask you something. It occurred to me, I talked about it this morning on the roundtable panel, but it occurred to me that it was very unlikely that Iran was going to drop a nuke on anyone. Because if they did, that would be their last day on Earth, because they would get hit back. But on the other hand, some of the relief that they wanted, and I don't know what the fine print says, was that they could have all the weapons they could get their hands on. And that wouldn't be too good. What do you make of that?
Well, there are a couple of things to say about that. One is they can't, at least not for 5 years.
Right.
There's several stipulations in this agreement. It is true that at the end of the sanctions relief, they'll be a lot richer. Their economy can go into high gear, and they can use that for consumer goods. They can use it for weapons.
How about oil? Can they sell oil?
Of course, they can sell oil, and I'm certain that they'll probably
price it right.
up at about 30. They'll probably up it in the next 3 or 4 years, 30% higher productivities. So, I mean, they will have a lot more money to use, and they could use it in weapons eventually. But their position is, and I think it's a fair position, is that they are a sovereign state. Why should they be treated any differently? If they have money, why shouldn't they use it in the way any sovereign state might want to use it? We have created controls, but those controls only exist for a few years. And at the end of those years, yes, they could develop many more weapons.
So we are banking, are we not, Tom Loeb, on the idea that if we are friends with them, things will get better. They will change during this 12-year period. Yes?
I don't think they're going to be our friends. I think that's an exaggeration of what's happened. For instance, I don't think we're going to be... compare this to our opening to Cuba. We immediately after we recognized each other and dropped the elements of the embargo, we immediately began to negotiate the reopening of our separate embassies. I don't think that's going to happen as quickly in this case. We're going to tiptoe along this road and see, you know, what kinds of relationships this will create. So there's the diplomatic issues, there's the economic issues, but then there are also the tactical and strategic issues. How will that affect the politics of the Middle East? And those are things I think that we should explore.
Well, I'm delighted that nobody has called 1-800-348-2551 so I can ask you more questions. And that question does, you just brought it up. Netanyahu is obviously very worried and saying, you know, this is really bad for Israel. And there are a lot of politicians in the United States, including John Boehner and all the others who invited Netanyahu to speak to a joint session of Congress. But one gets the feeling, at least I do, that nothing would have ever been enough with Netanyahu. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. This has changed the strategic calculation for Israel. It isn't good for Israel. I mean, Israel has been able to act with relative impunity in the Middle East. They have nuclear weapons. They never signed the NPT. Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Right.
They, along with India and Pakistan, are three countries that have nuclear weapons that never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There are no inspections. We don't know very much, or at least the international community knows next to nothing about, you know, what they have and how many bombs they actually have and what kind of targeting they have. They have been able to engage militarily with their neighbors. They attacked Iraq. They attacked Syria. They've attacked Lebanon repeatedly. This kind of activity, is now going to be challenged. Iran is a big country. It has a lot of people. It is potentially a strong economy, and Israel is now going to have to contend with a regional power. These are two separate sovereign nations that, you know, and Israel never wanted to deal with a competitor. And I think now it's going to have to.
And of course, it isn't only Israel in the Middle East. You know, there are two major divisions. So tell us about that.
You mean the Arabs? Are you talking about the Sunnis and the Shia
Arabs? Yeah, Sunnis and Shia.
So there are actually two different kinds of cross-cutting divisions in the Middle East. East outside Israel. The first is the divisions between Arabs and Persians. And the Persians, that is to say the Iranians, are very proud of the fact that they are not Arabs. And in fact, when I was in Iran, someone once said, "What, you know, do you know about the Arab-Persian War?" And I said, "Yes, it began in 1980. I thought I was smart. And they said, no, this is the war that occurred when the Arabs back in the 8th century invaded into Persia. So there, even the fact that they're Muslim is colored by the fact that it was Arab armies that brought Islam to their country. So there is this distinction between the Persian Empire.
Sure.
And the Arab world.
And yet, and we only have 1 second on this because then we have to take a short break, but
sure.
Yet there is a difference, Tom, am I wrong about this, between the Shia and the others?
The
Sunnis, of course, which side the Iranians are on, the Shia side?
Yes, they're overwhelmingly majority Shia. And along with the new government in Iraq, is also Shia. And then, of course, in Lebanon, Hezbollah is Shia. So there are minority Shia populations all over the Middle East and in South Asia. But Iran is the country that has a majority Shia and a government that is quite revolutionary.
Well, Tom Loeb, we are very fortunate to have you at Union College. We'll be right back, and then it's your turn, everybody. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I got to tell you, I'm having fun.
Support comes from Albany Realty Group, a local woman-owned real estate company since 2003, educating and counseling sellers and buyers throughout the real estate transaction, albanyrealtygroup.com. Lorac, serving the arts community year-round in downtown Glens Falls since 1972, with gallery exhibits and gift shop featuring handmade items by regional artists, larac.org. Pirates Lakeside Grill on Nassau Lake, serving local grass-fed beef, Milwaukee hot dogs and sausages, beer-battered fish fry and handmade milkshakes, piratelakesidegrill.com. Siegel Music Colony, Scroon Lake, New York, celebrating 100 years, bringing music to the North Country in 2015, with performances and events through August 16th. SiegelColony.org for schedule. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com. And Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire, featuring pavestone to help construct outdoor living spaces, walkways, retaining walls, pool decks, edgers, fire pits, and more. Whitney'sFarm.com.
And we are back with Professor Tom Loeb, an expert on U.S. foreign policy, the Middle East, among other topics. We're very much interested in what you have to say, 1-800-348-2551. We've heard from Paulette, who wants to know, I have a question. Why did we agree to not have access to all other sites in Iran? Was that wise?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not us. It's not the United States that has access. It's the IAEA, which I presume you want me to say.
Of course I do.
Is the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is where they were, the various parties were actually negotiating. Their headquarters are in Vienna, Austria. And the IAEA was very much part of this negotiation because it will be their task to inspect. And they have, the Iranian government did agree to allow the IAEA into all sites. Now, there's some ambiguity about something that the United States and other parties demanded, which is, could they, that the IAEA wanted to interview the various scientists working on nuclear projects. And this was part of the attempt to figure out what the Iranians had been doing, whether they were cheating in the past, and to try to get a clear view of the thing. And that isn't clear whether they're going to be able to interview these scientists, physicists that were working on the project. So the degree to which how intrusive the inspections will be is quite clear. The inspections are going to be incredibly intrusive. It's nothing, it's so much more intrusive, for instance, than the agreement that was made with North Korea. So in that sense, I think the negotiations were very successful on the West side.
But in the end, there has to be some trust that is developed, Tom Loeb. Right? In other words, we have to assume that one could play fast and loose with the rules. And if that starts to happen, then there is a question as to whether or not we have to take back the deal.
Yeah, Secretary Kerry, when he announced the deal, made it quite clear, and that was also true of various other spokesperson from various other countries, saying that this is not based on trust. This is based on verification, that there'll be cameras in all of the areas where there are reactors, that there will be frequent visits, unannounced visits.
But they have the right to object, don't they, is what I read?
They have the right to object to military sites, and there is, again, an ambiguity about that. But if they, so this is a little bit complicated. If, in fact, they keep objecting to areas that the IAEA feels is sensitive and they're hiding something, there is a committee of countries, representatives, that essentially report back to the United Nations that will essentially say they're not being open, that they're not allowing us to do our job. And that will create what is called a snapback regarding the sanctions.
Right.
And basically, they have 65 days for if the IAEA says they're not cooperating, this group of seven countries, representatives, has 65 days to give a review. And if the review, if four of those countries say they're not cooperating, then there's a snapback.
Huh. That's fascinating. Now, just one more little tour through the United Nations. Obviously, China and Russia and others are in on this.
Yes.
Who's friends with who?
Right. And that's interesting regarding the snapback, the question I just tried to answer. China and Russia are two of the countries, and Iran is the third. So the vote could be 4-3. That is to say, China and Russia are, in fact, have the most to gain regarding this agreement immediately. They can sell things, they can buy the oil now that the same, you know, they can make hay. And they were very supportive of this deal.
Supportive because we assume that because the Iranian economy was in the dumps and getting back, the Iranians wanted it and their pals were signing on.
Yeah, and they have contracts. There's oil deals, there's refineries, you know, all of the uranium is going to be sent to Russia. Russia is deeply embedded into this deal, and the Chinese have been sending all kinds of business people to make deals and have been doing this over the last 10 years.
And the I got to get these calls in a minute, but the Iranians, you're so fascinated, but the Iranians... And the Russians both have a lot of oil.
The Iranians and the Russians have a lot of oil, but the Russians use their oil. The Russians actually need more. As they get richer, they used to be a net exporter, but now they actually import.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, we'll go to John and Willow. All right, John, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Yes, hi. Okay, so I'm just prefacing by saying I'm not a big Obama supporter in many ways, but we won't go there because that's a whole conversation. But there's no question this is a legacy for him. It's a great success. You can't argue that, anything other than that. And it's particularly impressive. When Nixon went to China, he was the great anti-communist, right? So there was some legitimacy there politically for him making deal with the great devil. Obama does have trouble, obviously, because people see him like not trustworthy, and this isn't going to go over. But as far as I'm concerned, the deal is done. Khomeini cannot survive. His legitimacy, his religious legitimacy, is shot. Just in a way, like 10, 15 years later, Mao is a revered figure in the past, but they're doing business in the Western world. So that's what's and Iran is already far, far more developed.
Okay,
so I really see it as a process. In a way, it's like Westphalia. It's like the deal is signed between them and us, and things are going to change fast in Iran.
Well, let me put a caveat on that, and we still have a Congress to get through here. Tom Lowe, what's your reaction to this?
I agree with you. I think this is a historic deal, and I do want to. Urge a little bit of concern regarding your comment about Ayatollah Khomeini. He has as much of a problem getting this deal through as Obama does. And we should not forget that the Revolutionary Guard is truly a revolutionary force, that, you know, that they have a lot of stake in the economy and in the military. And that Rouhani, President Rouhani, has tried to sort of move back and forth. Even Ayatollah Khamenei has moved back and forth doing these negotiations, and he has to tread very carefully on this. So
are you saying, Tom, that there might be a potential revolution pushback from the guard?
I'm not saying there'll be a revolution. I'm saying that there's, you know, that we should not, just as we shouldn't see the United States as a one-dimensional decision-making model, a billiard ball type of model, so we shouldn't look at that in Iran. It, you know, Iran has many factions that are constantly fighting each other. We've seen that with every president that has been elected, from reform presidents to hardline presidents. And we've seen that with both Ayatollah Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. And, you know, and there is still this very hardcore revolutionary group that came to power in 1979 that remembers that the CIA launched a coup against a democratically elected president, Mossadegh, and that still sees the United States as the great Satan, and that they are a revolutionary force. So just as Mao was a revolutionary leader that then had to essentially, you know, sort of say, well, maybe we need to compromise, so Khamenei has to figure out how to sort of co-opt his revolutionary forces to move them, you know, forward. And that, I don't think that's as easy as, you know, as your callers suggested.
John, any comeback?
I didn't try to suggest that Khamenei is not going to be around, although, you know, but I'm just saying, like, even with China, there were factions all along that whole process who, you know, were trying for coups and they were trying to stop it. But it was inexorable because this is not real politics. This is the ecstatic nature of the Iranian revolution. And they don't have any there anymore. You know, they just signed a deal with the devil.
I hope you're right, and I think you're right, but I think it is a very dynamic process, and, you know, I'm excited to watch.
Tom, just for one second, take a minute, because one gets the impression that, you know, there's an older Iranian population which is aging out now. You have younger people who are coming out who really want to wear miniskirts or do what they want to do. And at some point, the Ayatollah is going to be infinitely outnumbered.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think one of the things that's fascinating is that Iran is an incredibly complex and modern country. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that, different than many countries in the Arab world, for instance, 62% of college graduates in Iran, and by the way, almost, you know, a huge percent of the people go to university. So 62% of all the people that graduate are women. 61% of all people that go to medical school are women. So it's not just that they're incredibly well educated and are seeking new jobs and want consumer goods, but the gender issues are absolutely fascinating and are turning, you know, turning upside down.
Something I hadn't even thought about. Thank you so much. Let's go to Jerry in Hyde Park. Jerry, you're on.
Oh, hi. I have a question for the professor. I'd like to know whether he thinks that this détente with Iran will actually lead to have a chilling effect on the ISIL activity in the area.
Yes, that's a great question. When you say chilling effect, do you mean that Iran and the United States will cooperate together to defeat ISIL? Is that what you're saying? Yes.
In fact,
they already have begun. This is one of those issues that, you know, has been discussed a little bit in the media, but is pretty much, you know, quiet. You know, there's definite cooperation between Western powers, particularly the United States, and Iranian authorities inside Iraq. I presume that's going to continue and probably accelerate. And the reason I think it's important, given the discussion we had earlier in our conversation, the reason is quite straightforward, which is that ISIL is a Sunni group that that wants to, you know, essentially kill Shia. And in that sense, both the Iraqi government that is led by Shia and the Iranian government, who are, of course, Shia, are the enemy. And so the Iranians feel very strongly that they would like to defeat ISIL.
Okay, thank you.
Jerry, thanks a lot.
Okay.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We welcome your calls. We want you to call. Let's go to Bob in Albany. All right, Bob, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Professor. Couple of things. One, the professor mentioned as a reason for Iranian hesitancy about being friends with America, the overthrow of the democratically elected government in the 50s. But there's a lot more recent reason. Don't forget that the Bush administration included Iran in the axis of evil and made it administrative policy for regime change. That's a decade ago. And even with that, anytime they poll the Iranian general population about their feelings towards America, it's always very positive. So it's a very mixed situation there, and it could go either way, depending on how the next administration, most probably, where it goes from here.
That's a great question, Bob. Let me just add on, if I may, an addendum. Tom Loeb, what do you expect to happen in the Congress when this appears before them?
So let me first reply to Bob about his point. That's an excellent point. There's a policy scholar named Trita Parsi who directs an organization in Washington, D.C. that's written a couple books that talks about this very point, that the United States has been both an enemy and adversary of Iran beginning, say, in 1953 with the coup, but then has done, you know, many, many acts that, you know, that increase that animosity. You mentioned the axis of evil. I think most people believe that if our invasion of Iraq had succeeded, that Iran would have been next, that Bush wanted to invade Iran. There is the civilian airplane that we shot down, and wherein I think around 300 lives were lost. I mean, there's countless acts of hostility by the United States, but there are also countless acts of hostility on the Iranian side as well. And Trita Parsi's point is there were many times when the United States and Iran over these last 35 years almost started negotiating, almost saw eye to eye, in particularly since 9/11. Both sides never lost an opportunity to lose an opportunity. So it's finally now that President Obama has actually focused on the issue and didn't lose this opportunity, maybe because he, you know, that all the other alternatives were so much worse. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we have been adversaries, and, you know, our hostility to the Iranian Revolutionary Government has been very dramatic.
One other thing, Alan, if I might.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
The other side of this coin is the Israeli opposition to any deal. And I listen and read a lot of things about this, and over and over and over I hear about how Israel is our number one ally in the Middle East, possibly in the whole world, and I honestly don't get that. I don't get what they do for us, although I'm sure they share intelligence and allow flyovers wherever we want to go, but, you know, this mantra that we always have to have Israel's interests first, because anything short of that will lead to their destruction, I think is just a ludicrous overstatement and simplification. leads us into making very bad policy.
Well, of course, of course, there's a political dimension to this, which has to do with the constituency in this country, right?
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, and Alan was just asking about, you know, Congress. I mean, the fact of the matter is that it is very difficult to be critical of Israel and Israel's policies. And, you know, the only president that actually, you know, got away with, you know, for just a short time being critical was President Bush the Elder. And you know, it was relatively successful. But for the most part, every president that we've had, you know, since Israel's founding has kowtowed to Israel.
Bob, I'm so sorry. We're hard up against a break here. I thank you so much for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye.
If you want to get in on it, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We are turning the corner, and we really want to hear from you. And your chances of getting in right now are excellent. Take it away, Zach.
Support comes from the Wild Center, featuring Wild Walk, 1,000 feet of elevated bridges and experiences in the Adirondack treetops. Wildcenter.org for details. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Washington County Tourism, presenting farmers markets, U-Picks, roadside farm stands, farm wineries, distilleries, and breweries throughout the county. WashingtonNYCounty.com. Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, welcoming Dakota Chamber Music Ensemble from Carnegie Hall tonight and July 21st at 7:30 p.m. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. Lori Ilvesacker, Coldwell Banker, Village Green Realty, Woodstock, a professional realtor with 30 years of experience specializing in the greater Woodstock area home market and in finding acreage for building new. 845-901-6129. And Habitat Post and Beam, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, designing and manufacturing energy-efficient post and beam homes and additions throughout the Northeast since 1972. Postandbeam.com.
And we are back. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Lots of phones ringing. Let's go to Jim in Ballston Lake. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. The reason I'm calling, I just came in and I noted what you were discussing, and
right.
I happened to hear on NPR radio they had Hillary Clinton's comment about the pact.
She's between a rock and a hard place. Can you remind us what she said? Because we're a little fuzzy on this.
You know, it was they only showed a snippet of it, so I can't tell. Maybe she heaped praise on the parties involved afterwards. But basically, she was so measured and so careful that there was actually no praise. She said, well, yeah, the Iran nuclear thing is done, but there's a lot of work to be done. That you went on and on about, you know, Iran's actions as far as supplying arms to our enemies and so forth.
Are you surprised?
She would have taken the occasion to at least praise John Kerry and all the people involved that have done this so far.
Yeah, well,
so just,
she wants to be president, and, you know, they're sitting in that round table, and they're trying to figure out what you say. Chuck Schumer today said, I'm going to look very carefully at every word in this agreement.
Because, well, you know,
yeah.
Either you support the president of the United States, who's, I think he's done a magnificent job on this.
Yep.
Hillary, I'm not a fan of her ever since she voted for the Iraq War. But I would vote for her if it was her against one of the Republicans. But she's like my fourth choice. She's so hesitant and so careful. I think she's afraid to do anything and make a mistake because she's afraid one little mistake will cost her the chance to run for president again like she did 8 years ago.
Tom?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a sensitive political issue. I think people like Schumer, Hillary Clinton, all the candidates are going to look at it politically long before they look at it in terms of the spirit of the negotiation itself. I mean, this every negotiation, whether it was is with Cuba or with Myanmar, the two previous negotiations that President Obama did, or under President Nixon with China, every negotiation is sensitive. It's filled with political drama. And there's a long road. The text of the deal will be analyzed carefully. And you're absolutely right. Hillary doesn't want to make any big mistakes that will explode in her face. The last thing to say about this is many Americans feel that Iran is a special country, that it is a country that, you know, that took Americans hostage, that invaded the U.S. embassy. Again, we talked earlier about how the Iranians look at us and the bad things that we did to Iran. But of course, you know, Iran also, you know, has, you know, there are reverse perceptions here. And so many Americans sort of see that, you know, normalizing in some way relations with Iran is a sellout. And what Obama has to now do is to sell this very serious negotiated deal and see where it goes. You know, does it lead further so that we have better relations on other fronts? This is just a limited deal about nuclear weapons, but can we move further in terms of making agreements on other issues, political issues, military issues, economic issues? Will we be part of the new investment wave in Iran? All these questions are issues that people like Hillary have to be very careful about.
Jim, thank you for the call. Appreciate
it. Let's just add one thing.
Sure.
For some reason, I have this good feeling about the young people in Iran. There have been I saw a couple of travel documentaries where someone from PBS went around and traveled around Iran speaking to the young people, and they're so with it.
Yeah, it's a point I made earlier
program. I think it was a year or so ago. There's a popular rock song here in the United States. And these young Iranian, two women and two guys, made a video of themselves dancing to the song, dressed in very American European clothing, and there was a threat to arrest them for that kind of behavior.
Sure.
But the even the Prime Minister of Iran came to their aid. That people have a right. That song was called "Be Happy" or something.
Yeah.
So I think this is an important step, and I think we got to try to attach ourselves to the young people in Iran.
Okay. Thank you
very much. Thanks
very much. Appreciate it. Let's go. Okay, John, we're not going to take your call because we only take one to a customer, especially right now. Thank you very much, John, for calling. Thinks Netanyahu is not really so unhappy. He may have another agenda. Okay. Well, thank you for that. And let's go to number four here, which is Michael in Guilderland. Michael, you're on.
Good afternoon. I first of all wanted to say that the comment about the U.S. always kowtowing to Israel is a racist comment, and your speaker should have really been a bit more sensitive than to make a comment like that.
But I never heard such a comment. I never heard him say kowtowing. Did you?
That's exactly the word that your speaker used.
Did you? Okay. He's nodding. Yeah.
So, secondly, I would like to remind.
And by the way, why is that? Is it the kowtowing that is the racist part, or the Israel thing that is the racist part?
It is racist to make a false allegation, to put people to basically slander Israel, and your comment, Alan, about that it's the Jewish interest in the United States. First of all, it's a false comment. It's historically false.
Yeah.
And besides that, it is meant to be injurious and harmful. But I would like to get.
Well,
to
wait
the point.
A second. Now, I just like to defend myself. I happen to be a Jew, number one. Number two, I happen to. And so is the guest. And I happen to be a big admirer of Israel and have been there. And I have to tell you, I think you're way off base and should apologize.
Alan, I've been listening to your comments about Israel for a long time, and
be careful not to lie, because I have always been a fierce supporter of Israel. So if you're going to tell a lie, that is unacceptable.
Well, I would say mutually, but would you let me get to my point?
No, not if you're going to lie.
Well, that is your perception of it, which is very incorrect. You're the one who brought
that's
up
another lie.
On this, you brought up on this conversation that it's the Jewish interest in America.
There is a political reality that the Jewish interest, there are a lot of Jewish voters, they feel passionately about it. I happen to feel passionately about it, and that's a reality. So don't make up lies. I don't like it.
It's not just the Jewish voters. There happen to be also many Christian voters who are pro-Israel and many moderates
that's
who
true.
Are pro-Israel, and also people who want to protect Israel from people like the Ayatollah Khomeini. And what your speaker seems to be completely leaving out is that Iran is the sponsor of terrorism throughout the Middle East and elsewhere. They were the sponsor of Hezbollah when Hezbollah blew up over 200 American Marines in Lebanon.
All true.
They control Lebanon. They control a good part of Iraq. Mm-hmm. They are the sponsor for Syria and his and
that's all true. Okay. Oh, that's all true. Tom, nothing, no more. Okay. Well, look, Michael, fine. But in the future, try not to lie. Okay. That's very important.
You're
you
the
just
liar,
get...
Alan.
Oh, no, you don't. Okay. Okay. Let's go to Art in Saugerties. Art, you're on.
I wonder why in all of these discussions, the big thing that's been omitted is that before the discussions began with the Iranians, the administration unfroze almost $12 billion worth of Iranian accounts in banks around the world and in foreign investments. In other words, they bribed them to the table. How come that is not reported in the media and by you people?
And by you people? Is that, what is it about the calls today, you people? I'm a little insulted by that. And go ahead, Tom, did you want to say something?
Well, I mean, yes, the United States and other countries have frozen Iranian accounts. That is fairly normal. I mean, we also, you know, adversaries, you know, try to use various tools to gain power over them. We certainly, after the Cuban Revolution and after we broke relations with Cuba and began the embargo, we froze assets in the United States, Cuban assets. So that's fairly normal, and I do believe that has been reported. In fact, that was very much part of the negotiation when and how quickly the United States unfreeze, and that's very different than other countries or the United Nations resolutions. But when will the United States unfreeze the assets that have been frozen either since 1980 or soon thereafter? It's a very good question, but my understanding is that will happen in stages.
I have a question for you, Art, if I may. How did you find out about this?
Me?
No, Art. Art,
hello.
How did you find out about it? Since the media and
I
quote
found
and
out
quote
about it,
since the media and quote you people didn't
on, yeah. A EWTN program by Raymond Arroyo world over.
So somebody told you about it, right? In other words, you heard about it through the media. Is that what I'm hearing from you? In other words, I've got you cold.
Yeah, one part of the media.
Yeah,
that,
well, so but you people.
That's to the New York Times line.
Yeah,
and
I
believe
see.
Me, I spent 40 years reporting and editing, so I know the difference.
Are you part of the you people?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Ed in Salt Point. Ed, you're on.
Yes, just an initial comment about Iran and Alan Beck. And congratulations for standing your ground with the previous speakers. It's very important. I would use the term confusing or misinforming, not necessarily lying.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
Basically, you're doing a great job. Anyway, my comment on the whole thing is to draw what I think is an interesting parallel between what is going on in the Greek negotiation with the Germans, the Germans who are running that, and the the Iran deal. The Iran thing, whether you're for it or against it, nothing's perfect. It shows what diplomacy can achieve, where there's recognition of some sort of equality of the parties at the table, and you try to work out differences. Whereas in the Greek situation, that was just imposed by diktat from the German side, and amounts to a coup. A quick comment on why the Germans are doing this, in my opinion, is the Germans are terrified that the euro will unravel, because if the euro unravels, then they're back to the Deutschmark, which, of course, would be overvalued, not necessarily overvalued, would be highly valued, and would hurt their export engine, which they currently have. That's why they're doing this, and why, to some degree, not just because they are inflexible Germans, but they're reacting very irrationally to the Greek situation. Anyway, my basic comment was to draw a contrast between diplomacy and diktat.
And it was a good comment. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Can I make a comment about that previous questioner regarding Israel?
Yeah.
There were a couple of things that he said that I think need to be corrected. First of all, Iran does not control Lebanon. Iran does have a powerful ally in Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is part of the government, but Hezbollah does not control the government, and that was an incorrect comment. Lebanon is a very it is a very open country, and Hezbollah is a part of the political process. They are a powerful voice. They do have a strong militia, military, and I think many people should be concerned about that. But they are not. Iran is not a 10-foot giant marching through the Middle East, not at all. The other thing that I wanted to say about Israel is that I think we earlier asked the question, why is the United States supporting Israel? Why is Israel such a good friend of the United States? And I think the questioner took issue regarding that. And I think both Alan and I are, Our position is that it's just a matter of fact that every president has aligned itself with Israel, including President Obama, during the entire negotiating process. He says that number one is we are going to watch out for the national security interests of Israel. Now, we shall see how this, transpires, what will happen. My view is that Israel itself will have to reassess and is already reassessing its strategic calculation throughout the Middle East. But, I do believe for whatever reason, and we may disagree about what the reason is, but for whatever reason, the United States has been very close to Israel. And that is quite indisputable.
It's true. Okay. Jordan, we only have a second now, so could you just put it in one sentence? Go ahead.
Yeah, real quick, and I'm sorry if you've already been over this. You mentioned the revolution, the coup, in Iran, and I'm wondering if you've already been over this.
We have.
Okay, and the Mossadegh, and just the quick question is, did we bring upon ourselves the radicalism of the mullahs in Iran by conducting that coup at the behest of British Petroleum or whatever it was?
That is what most people believe. Stephen Kinzer, who is a reporter, was a reporter for the New York Times, is now, I believe, at Brown. Stephen Kinzer has written a couple of books on the 1953 coup, and his view is that without this democratically elected President Mossadegh not having been overthrown, Iran may have had a completely different trajectory.
And I am so sorry, because we are out of time. Ellen from Shelburne Falls says she's Jewish, but critical of Jewish occupation of Palestine. We're out of time. Thomas Loeb of Union College, thanks so much. Support for Vox Pop comes from Saratoga Saddlery, Saratoga Springs, New York, an equestrian lifestyle boutique featuring cowboy boots by Lucchese and Ariat for women, men, and kids on Facebook and SaratogaSaturday.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. SPAC, presenting New York City Ballet, featuring CDPHP Family Night, Friday evening, July 17th, with pre-performance instrument, petting zoo, and children's workshops on the lawn, sponsored by Albany Medical Center. SPAC.org for tickets. And George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts, family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation services and deliveries. Thanks again for everybody for being with us today. Our engineer is Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Paulette Ryder. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. And stay tuned now for a news update. Again, Thomas Loeb of Union College, thanks so much for being here.